NBI Studios. This is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. On August 16, 2005, in the West Campus area of Austin, Texas, 21-year-old Jennifer Cave goes out to the bar with a friend to celebrate the fact that she was going to start a new job the next day. But Jennifer never showed up to work that Monday morning. 2 days later, her mutilated body was discovered by her family in an apartment belonging to the very same friend that she went out for drinks with. The case seemed open and shut. In fact, her friend Colton Petoniak even confessed to her murder on the stand at his own trial. But things aren't always as obvious as they appear. Is it possible that Colton was wrongfully convicted for a crime that he fully admitted to in court? Joining me today to help try to answer that question are the hosts of the Orange Tree podcast, Haley Butler and Tanu Thomas. Both journalism students, Haley and Tanu spent over a year investigating this case and reporting their findings through a 7-part podcast. This is Season 9, Episode 12, The Case of the Murder at the Orange Tree Condos.
Texas Ranger James Holland is a legendary interrogator. They call him the serial killer whisperer.
You can't hide those indications, and that's why yesterday I knew that you did it.
But now, shocking interrogation tapes reveal how the super cop really operates.
And that's why they asked me to come in, because I'm special.
From Something Else, The Marshall Project, and Sony Music Entertainment, this is Smokescreen. Just say you're sorry. Listen and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You were up at 4, baking pastries at 5, and open at 6. 100th cappuccino by 8, 200th customer by 9, and there's still 12 hours to go. That's why you need a business broadband that works as hard as you do. Introducing Sky Business. With 4G internet backup and our stay connected guarantee, that's better business. To find out more, visit skybusiness.com. Sky Fiber only, 30-second 4G activation or one-off credit. New customers, Pro Plus packs only. T's and C's apply.
I'm joined on the phone today with the creators of the Orange Tree podcast, Miss Haley Butler and Miss Tanu Thomas. How are you guys doing today?
We're doing good. Yeah, we're doing super well. How are you?
Really well. We were just discussing before we got on the air that we're having unseasonably warm weather here in Michigan, so I feel like a Texan.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
So are you guys from Texas, or how did you end up meeting at the University of Texas? Were you guys from the area, or did you come from other places?
Yeah, we were seniors in college when a professor hired us to start an audio production house out of the journalism school. So they wanted to kind of like recreate a major podcast production house, like a Wondery or a Gimlet, but, you know, use our students, abilities to do something like that. So we were hired as the first two hires. And, you know, the journalism school is pretty small. So it was really shocking when Tanu and I have never met before until we were both hired for this project. And so we met then right before we started the Orange Tree podcast.
And that was both of your senior years?
Yeah, it was our last semester of our senior year when we met.
Right. So where are you guys from? Are you originally from Texas?
Yeah, so I'm originally from New York. That's where I grew up. And then my parents moved to South Texas when I was in high school. So then I ended up going to the University of Texas.
Yeah, I'm actually from Austin. And so I, you know, just stuck around. I've always wanted to leave Texas, like tried every single opportunity, like graduation in high school, graduation in college, to leave Texas. But through it all, I'm so glad I'm here.
Well, yeah, you guys got Joe Rogan now.
Yeah, we do have Joe Rogan now. Tanu's a huge fan. Huge fan.
Yeah, he's, I was just listening to his podcast the other day, and it sounds like he's pulling all of the LA comedians are all now following him down to Texas. You guys should have quite a comedy scene once the pandemic's over.
Yeah, I think he's like, you know, buying up some spaces that were at risk of like being sold or like not being around anymore afterwards.
Yep. So you guys are seniors at the University of Texas at Austin. And you said the whoever was wanted to create this audio production house came to both of you independently.
Yeah, he had a job opening looking to see if there's anybody interested in like audio production that was a journalism student. And Tanu and I had like experience in, you know, like newspaper writing and like magazine writing. But ultimately what we were thinking in the back of our minds is we want to be either NPR journalists or podcast journalists, like long form journalists. So as soon as this ad came up, you know, this job application came up and was circling around the journalism school, we both applied immediately. And then, yeah, we were the two chosen to start this.
That's so cool. And is that when you guys say at the beginning of your episodes that this is a production by The Drag? Is that the production house that was created?
Yeah, that's right. So Haley, myself, and Robert came together and we were trying to envision what the podcast production house would be. And we came up with The Drag and yeah, it started.
Yeah, The Drag is, that's what a bunch of students have always called this street, like surrounding campus. It's called Guadalupe, but the nickname of the street is The Drag. And so it's kind of like an older thing. Like I feel like UT students from, you know, like 80s, 90s, early 2000s always called it The Drag. Not so much anymore, but yeah, we thought we'd pay a little homage to it.
That's awesome. That was going to be my next question. Where did we come up with The Drag? Now, is Robert, you said the name of the gentleman that posted the job originally?
Yeah. Robert Quigley is the executive producer of The Drag. So yeah, he's the one that started the whole operation.
So what was his vision as he explained it to you when you got hired? Was the purpose, because The Drag is, it's a nonprofit, right?
It's a nonprofit. Yeah. It's, his vision was basically, you know, everybody at the journalism school loved podcasts like Serial and Dr. Death. And there wasn't really an opportunity for our journalism students to like do long form journalism, which is what a lot of people liked. But people mostly stuck to like breaking news and UT news and kind of like one off things. But we have a top journalism school in the nation. And, you know, I think he felt compelled to like kind of be more innovative within the program. So yeah, that's what his vision was.
So is it, I know it's a job outside of your classes. Has it been integrated into part of the journalism program or is it standalone outside of it?
Yeah, it is. So there's a capstone class, a journalism capstone class. And so what happened was Tanu and I graduated. And then we basically were like, we were already, you know, like a few months into the Orange Tree production. So we wanted to stick around. And the way that we could do that was integrate what we've learned so far in building the Orange Tree and using, Robert also has this capstone class. So he brought in some of the podcast production into the capstone class. So there's like an innovative course now where students can learn, you know, what are the ins and outs of making a long form podcast, what that's like. And so for us to be able to stick around and finish the Orange Tree after we graduated, we helped out with the class. And so that's kind of what like funded us and like our living and, you know, kept us alive until we were able to publish the Orange Tree. And we don't work for UT anymore. We're doing some freelance podcasts now, but yeah, it is integrated into the program.
That's really cool. So there's actually now a class. So what's interesting about the podcast, the long form, especially in the long form true crime podcasting genre is, you know, it kind of really became a thing in 2014 with Serial. And then there became, you know, and of course, Sarah Koenig was an actual journalist. And then there came along thousands, if not millions of people like me who have no journalistic background that started creating these podcasts and reporting on it. And it's like, it's kind of coming full circle. So now it's going back into the journalism school where they're actually teaching journalists how to create a podcast.
Right. 100%. Yeah. I think it's, it's something that we particularly like about the long form, like, medium. You know, we've been offered to do kind of like short form kind of true crime stuff, but we really like to stick to the like deep dive kind of investigative journalism work that, you know, we started at the journalism school and that we were kind of taught how to do.
Yeah, I think like the audio has always existed for like journalism students, because we're always going around with a recorder and like encouraged to record everything that we come across that's interesting. And, you know, for all of our stories, we have so much audio recorded because, you know, we need to transcribe it and write it up later for our pieces and articles. So it was just a natural thing for them to integrate podcasting into the journalism curriculum because, you know, the audio is already there. We already know how to make it so that the interviews are like seamless and interesting. So it just felt like something that was waiting to happen. And then it did.
I think that's really, really cool. And you know, I listened to the whole podcast. It's fabulous. It's and one thing that I noted is not only is the content really well done, but the sound design is really well done. Where did that expertise come from? I mean, did either of you have a background in audio engineering or audio production, or did Robert, or did you guys hire someone? How did a group of journalist students, as you said, that wrote for, you know, magazines and things like that, put together such a well-crafted podcast?
That's so nice.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much. Tanu and I were just really interested in those kinds of things and always getting better at it. So we did the, you know, audio production classes that the journalism school offered, which was a total of one. And then we basically went on from there to practice on our own.
Yeah, we tell students all the time, and most interviews that we do, especially for when we know young people are listening, we tell them that when we started the Orange Tree, it was like all a learning process. So like while we were producing, we were constantly sending each other like tips on like things that we were discovering. And really a lot of the learning happened online because UT and the journalism school specifically really encourages us to like learn on our own and tackle our education like independently. So that's kind of what we did when we wanted to learn the audio, like the production aspect of it. So a lot of it was like learned through YouTube and like Reddit. When we couldn't figure something out, we just like would go ask questions online, figure it out. And then that's kind of how that happened.
That's awesome. I think I say this every week, every time we do one of these, but the process is so, in so many cases, is so similar, even with the different backgrounds, because we went through, myself and Mike, our producer, you know, we were both firefighters and started this podcast. And then, you know, just like you, you know, we like downloaded a free version of Audacity and then got on YouTube and learned how to do basic editing and then and still learning as we go to try and improve things.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's one of the most like beneficial things that we ever did was just in college recording stuff in our closet. Sometimes it didn't even make sense, but like just recording stuff in our closet so we could bring it into whatever audio software we were using and kind of mess around with it.
Right.
You know, sometimes you don't like to hear, you know, your own voice when you're playing back. Tanu and I definitely got really sick of hearing our own voice when we were editing The Orange Tree. But I mean, there's something so like, you know, you might not consider yourself like a painter or a sculptor or something, but you really do feel kind of like an artist whenever you're experimenting in audio software. So that part was like so fun.
Yeah, I agree. And Mike, I always joke around to call him the podcast mechanic because it's amazing. He takes his art very seriously to try to make everything sound just perfect. And it just amazes me that people without the background have the resources available to them to learn how to do that kind of work that I'm pretty sure 20 years ago, no one could. These weren't things that were readily accessible.
Right. Yeah. I mean, just the internet makes things so easy to like learn and figure out. And I love the podcast medium because it is so accessible to people. And, you know, if you have a computer and a mic, like you can create like the next best podcast. That's awesome. Like that's such a cool, accessible thing. You don't need to necessarily, we love our university, but you don't necessarily need to go to college to figure this out. Like you can just get on your computer and really watch a lot of YouTube videos and invest in that.
Yeah, it's really cool. Now, I'm assuming that when you guys decided to go to college, to journalism school that your goal in life was not to become podcasters, or am I wrong about that? What was your goal when you started journalism school as far as your career?
So actually, like, when we both started college in general, we neither of us were journalism majors to begin with. Like, both of us switched into journalism in general, like, around our junior year. So, like, right as we were supposed to be figuring out, like, you know, what we're going to do right after college, we both decided to do, like, a complete turnaround. Yeah. And so I was doing nursing. And when I got into journalism, I was super focused on print. And then it was around the time that Robert put out the post about the audio journalism position that I was like, I'm really into podcasting and I've done audio stories before. So let's try this thing out.
Yeah. And whenever I first started at UT, I was a Russian major. And then I switched over from Russian,
wow,
Eastern European studies to journalism, just because, you know, I think there's so much value to a journalism degree that people don't really understand, or they might write off, given like the current news cycle situation we have, they might write it off as a useless degree or something. But I learned so much about not only just like communication with other people, but, you know, like communities and like engagement. Like, I don't know. It was just like, it's a very eye-opening thing. So it was a very easy switch from trying to learn the Russian language to this.
Yeah, I was just trying to figure out what I could switch my major to, where I could like write and also tell my parents that I wasn't an English major. So,
So now that you are both graduated, you made an incredibly well done and incredibly successful podcast. What are your career goals now? I heard you say that you're doing a little bit of freelance work. Do you plan on going into a full-time career as podcasting journalist, or do you have another path in mind?
Yeah. I mean, good question. It's so funny because when people ask us this, I still feel like I'm a student, because like we're both only 23 years old. And so we're just like still kind of like figuring it out. But for right now, we're doing podcasts that are very Orange Tree-esque. Which I think is like very exciting, because investigative journalism is like what I want to do. And I think Tanu will agree with me on this, but I can't see myself being an investigative journalist in any other medium, truthfully. That's not saying I'm counting it out, but there's something so exciting and humanizing about a podcast that I want to keep doing.
Yeah. After we finished The Orange Tree, there were like a lot of people that wanted to ask us what we would be doing. And a lot of people came to us asking if we would want to work in like different fields and like, you know, having to do with journalism, but, or like having to do with audio. But luckily we did get an opportunity to work independently and continue to produce podcasts like The Orange Tree. And we both jumped at the chance to do that. So that's exactly what we're doing.
Awesome. Well, it sounds like you guys have another podcast in the works.
Yeah, we actually do. So we're working on two new projects. I don't know how much we can talk about, but like Haley said, they are, they're both very similar in that they're long form. They have to do with, and they're still in the same genre, and we're still able to report and do the production and stuff like that. So
yeah,
pretty fun, pretty exciting. And so you can look forward to those coming out soon.
Yeah. I think in like late spring is when we can announce everything. But yeah, it's pretty cool because it's like the same exact dynamic as The Orange Tree, like, which, you know, Tanu and I always talk about how much we loved working together for The Orange Tree and how great it was to have, you know, the support of a friend and like an excellent co-director. And we get to do that again with like two hosts, you know, in all of that jazz.
Well, that's awesome. All right. So the last thing that I want to ask before we shift into talking about the case, the murder of Jennifer Cave, is, Haley, can you say, right after a short break, let's get into the case in Russian?
Oh, shit. I don't think I can. I don't remember anything. I'm not going to lie. I dropped it so fast. I dropped it so fast. It was one of those things where my mom told me it would be a good idea to do this. And then I just kind of ran with it, you know, like I read one book, like Master and the Margarita. I was like, this is cool. And then I learned the alphabet and I was like, I am on top of it. And then I forgot everything. The only thing I know how to say is like, I love reading and I think that's it.
Do that one and just say that's what it is. Can she do that
one? Then let's hear I love reading.
Я люблю учить книги.
Right after the break.
All right. So now we're going to get into this fascinating case that you guys covered that had a hell of a twist to it, the way you guys laid it out and produced it. Can you guys first go through just the beats of the case? We're talking about the murder of Jennifer Cave. It occurred in 2005 in August in the West Campus area of Austin. So kind of break us through the beats of the case as far as what happened leading up to her murder, how she was found, and the suspects, later the defendants, their actions afterwards.
Yeah, 100%. So Jennifer Cave is a 21-year-old girl in 2005. She's from Corpus Christi, and she ends up being, you know, she ends up coming to Austin after trying to figure out what she wants to do for a while. While she's trying to figure out what she wants to do, like her career path and whatnot, she's working as a waitress at Austin and has a few friends, you know, typically like partiers, you know, like just like young people trying to have like a good time. And so she knows this guy named Colton Batoniak, who is a business student at UT. And he's like kind of a high school prodigy, kind of like academic prodigy, while he was living in Arkansas. But he was at UT at this point. He, you know, sold some drugs, like loved to party. And, you know, his schooling was kind of like, he wasn't doing the best in school at this time, but him and Jennifer were pretty good friends. And Jennifer, after going through this whole thing, you know, trying to figure out what she wants to do with her life, she gets a job at a law firm. And it's like a front desk position, but they like absolutely adore her. So they give her like a better job than the one that she even applied for. So like everybody in her life was so stoked for her because, you know, this was kind of like the turning of the new leaf kind of thing. Her parents were worried about her. She, you know, she wanted to have a good time, hang out with her friends, but she also knew that this is what she wanted to do. And like, this is how to get back on track. So she ends up meeting with Colton, who said he wanted to celebrate, you know, Jennifer's new job. And they go down to 6th Street, you know, where everybody goes to party in Austin. And, you know, they have a few drinks. Colton's like been a heavy drinker that whole night, you know, taking some Xanax too, mixing that together. And at some point they leave 6th Street around midnight, trying to find Colton's phone. And they end up heading back to the Orange Street condos, which is, as you said, right in the West Campus area where Colton lives. And the next morning, I mean, nobody can, you know, Jennifer didn't show up for her job. People are kind of freaking out. The law office ends up going to Jennifer's apartment, trying to find her. Nobody can find her. Her mom's calling her. You know, where's Jennifer? Where's Jennifer? Where's Jennifer? And, you know, what ended up happening that night is basically Colton wakes up at like 5 a.m., finds his phone at some point, I guess, and wakes up to find Jennifer's body in his bathtub. And he says that he has no recollection really of that morning until he remembers that he had texted his like kind of like girlfriend, not really, just kind of like friends with benefit situation, Laura Hall, who was a UT student at the time. She was a government major. And at some point he had texted her in the morning wanting her to come over. So Laura's on her way because she really likes Colton. Colton sees Jennifer's body, asks Laura not to come over, but Laura comes over anyway.
So was that's one thing I was a little confused about. Did he, according to his story, did he text her and ask her to come over before he found Jennifer's body?
So, yeah.
So according to his story, he invited her to come over because they were supposed to hang out the night before. He was kind of like either avoiding it or had gotten too drunk to like really reply to her that night. So the next morning he finds her phone, he replies to her, goes to the restroom, to use the restroom, sees Jennifer's body, and then immediately texts Laura back saying, "Hey, never mind. Do not come over here."
Yeah. That's the story he presented in court. So we don't know exactly what happened over the next few hours, but all we know is that there is a list written of some supplies. People kind of run various different errands. Colton goes to this local hardware shop called Breeding Company and picks up the list of supplies that's written, including, you know, just like Febreze and like 55-gallon drum liners, and then also a hacksaw, comes back to the orange tree. And, you know, there are different accounts of what happened here. They both, Colton and Laura, kind of blame, you know, each other for this. But like at some point in that morning, afternoon, Jennifer's body is dismembered and her head is cut off. And so are her hands. And at this point, Jennifer's family is getting the police involved. Colton and Laura get word of that. And at some point in that evening, they flee to Mexico. So they take Laura's green Cadillac and go to Mexico and leave Jennifer's body behind. And that's when you pick up the next day. That's when our first episode picks up of the Orange Tree, where Sharon and Jim start their own investigation on finding their daughter Jennifer and end up finding Jennifer's body in Colton's apartment.
So before we move on from here, I want to talk about the dismemberment a little bit, because I did some reading online. I listened to the show and then did some reading online about this. And it said the prosecutor presented to the jury as though the dismemberment, he said there was no purpose behind it. It was just playing, you know, I think his words were that it was like they were just playing with the body, cutting it up. But I'm curious what your impressions of that are, because when I read about this and listened to it, what seemed like what happened to me was they put together a plan to dismember the body and get rid of the body and got started on it, and either stomachs were too weak for it, realized it was harder work than they thought it was going to be, or for whatever reason, they abandoned the plan and that's what they went to Mexico. What are you guys' feelings on the dismemberment of Jennifer's body?
Well, it's really hard for us to like have like certainty in any of these things, but we do know what people have said, like the people involved in the case. So obviously we know the prosecutors, what they presented was that, you know, they were playing with the body. But what Colton said was he doesn't remember that morning, but he must have been scared and trying to get rid of it. And just, you know, he was drinking and taking some Xanax still all that morning. So that's what he said. And Laura, you know, she denies it now, but and also back then she was going back and forth on whether or not there was a reasoning behind it. But she also, that was the understanding from what she said, which was that they were trying to get rid of it. And, you know, if you look at the list of the materials that they're buying, like the gallon drum bags, I mean, someone could paint the picture of like they're trying to get rid of something. But again, we can never really know for sure what those gallon drum bags were. I mean, maybe they were just trying to throw out trash.
Yeah, we definitely have talked to people that are kind of thinking along the same lines as you, whether it be, you know, lawyers or investigators mm-hmm. on Colton or Laura's behalf that suggests like maybe they were trying to separate the body parts in order to prolong the identification of the body. But yeah, we really don't know for sure what they were thinking, but that is definitely a theory that is out there.
Right. And they, it should be noted, they left the head and hands behind when they fled the scene. They were there in a bag, right?
Yes.
Yeah. They actually left everything. Yes. The theory presents, like it looked like they were maybe starting to put things into the bags and then stopped around the time that they took off, because they were hearing that the cops weren't coming to the apartment, because they did receive a call like shortly beforehand saying, hey, like this was a call from, he was getting several calls from Jennifer's mother asking where Jennifer was, and then also from Jennifer's ex-boyfriend saying, hey, like you better tell us the truth because the cops are going to come to your place soon. So at that point, you know, they just pick up and left. You know, we don't really know if it was an intentional move, if they meant to leave it behind, if they meant to take it but didn't have time. But what we do know is that they left it behind and took off.
Right. And took off and left the country.
Exactly. Right. So They flee. They make it to a town like right over the border, Piedras Negras. And while Colton and Laura are in Mexico, there's this picture that surfaced of them sitting at the hotel manager's house watching, what was it, MMA? Was it an MMA fight?
It was a wrestling.
Yeah. It was like a wrestling match where they were drinking. And it clearly looks like they were like having the time of their life, like with the smiles on their face. So, you know, we can kind of presume that they're kind of like, a lot of people think that it's like a Bonnie and Clyde situation. They think that they've gotten out, that they could like, you know, party and have fun. But they're there for 5 days. And while they're there, you know, back in the States, like the funeral is happening. Austin's in kind of a panic because nobody can figure out where Colton is. But eventually the police get word and, you know, marshals, you know, are able to ultimately find them. And because they're using their credit cards in their own name, they're using their cell phones. Ultimately, after a few days, it wasn't very hard to find them. But whenever they're taken back into the States, they both go on trial. They have separate trials. Colton's is first. And Colton's trial, his attorneys ultimately decide to go with this kind of theory where it's like Colton is guilty of the murder of Jennifer Cave, but he didn't do it intentionally. And so they put him on the stand saying that he doesn't remember. And, you know, Eddie and Bridget Petoniak and also Colton have regrets about going with this theory or letting the lawyers go with this theory now, because, you know, that the original trial really like limited them in terms of what they can present in appeals later on. So they're really regretful of that strategy. But Colton was ultimately sentenced to 55 years in prison. He has to serve, I believe, half of it before he's eligible for parole. And Laura's trial was next. And so Laura was originally up for just hindering apprehension, taking him to Mexico. But then they ultimately added the charge of the dismemberment of the body. And that's actually when her trial was going on, the charge was specifically called tampering with evidence. It wasn't like there wasn't like a charge for like a dismemberment of a corpse. It went, this tampering with evidence went back to like gravedigger times. So the max amount of sentence that she could be handed was 10 years. You know, she has some crazy antics in her trial. And you know, when you listen to the podcast, you can hear about it. But she was ultimately sentenced to 5 years. But then her lawyer, Joe James Sawyer, got her an appeal. An appeal went through where she got a retrial. And she got a resentencing specifically. So people were reevaluating whether, you know, she should spend those 5 years. Maybe she could get less. But what ultimately happened was this prosecutor named Allison Wetzel found all of these jail phone calls that she was making to, you know, people in her life where she was very threatening to a lot of people involved in the case, including Sharon, Jennifer's mom. And it did not look very good for her. She also had some jailhouse confessions at that time. So a woman named Henriette Lagenbach told police that Laura confessed to the murder. So all of that was kind of like on the docket for Laura by the time her retrial was up. So the jury actually sentenced her to 10 years instead of 5.
Which was crazy. I've actually never heard of that happening where someone wins their appeal, gets their conviction vacated, and then ends up with a worse sentence than they had to begin with when it was all over.
Right. Yeah. It was really wild. Like no one saw that coming, but even her lawyer will say like that was something that they really couldn't avoid because of the jail phone calls. And the prosecutor, Allison Wetzel, was really smart to have like gone through and like looked for those because, yeah. You know, Laura had this history of saying inflammatory things and doing inflammatory things in her previous trial and even throughout Colton's trial. And knowing that she just had this idea that she would obviously not really refrain or restrain herself when she was making phone calls and awaiting her retrial. So she went through them and she found what she was looking for. And once presented, it was really hard to for the jury not to do anything about that. In fact, like in one of the episodes, we mentioned that she even like it's like she knew who was going to be in that courtroom. She even like said something about the judge.
Yeah,
that was pretty
inflammatory.
Inflammatory. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So she, yeah, it is pretty crazy. So she was sentenced to 10 years, the maximum amount of sentence that someone can serve for tampering with evidence. And since then, in terms of like the new information that I think that we kind of unveiled to the public, are Colton's appeals. And so he's had a number of appeals that have been, very interesting. He's added a lot more like confessions, like Laura talking in prison to her cellmates and things like that, and confessing to the entire murder of Jennifer Cave. And so, you know, those are included in Colton's appeals, as well as Jason Mack, who Laura saw while they were kind of like crossing paths in one of the courthouses. He was involved in an appeal that said that Laura confessed to him to shooting Jennifer. And that's, you know, originally how she died was a gunshot wound to the right side of her body. So she confessed to Jason Mack, who was also like heading to prison at the same time that she shot Jennifer. And so, I mean, the appeals are very interesting, and, you know, the involvement in with both of the families is really heartbreaking, because, you know, for Colton's parents, you know, they believe his son is innocent, so they're like fighting tooth and nail to like get their son out of prison or get a retrial. And all the while that this is going on, Sharon and Jim and Jennifer's family, they're showing up to every single appeal, every single hearing, because they believe that, you know, Colton was definitely the one that shot Jennifer. So, you know, there's just been a lot of emotion over the past 15 years that I just don't think that a lot of people knew about. And that was a huge motivator for us to tell this story and kind of tell it as much as we possibly could to the UT community, to the Austin community. So I don't think a lot of people knew about it.
Right. You know, I, even when I started listening to the show, you know, it was several of my listeners that suggested I give it a listen. I honestly didn't see the ambiguity coming that we see at the end. I mean, it seemed very cut and dry. Colton did it. That, you know, it was just like you're telling a story. Obviously, he did it. He dismembered her. And, you know, it just so happened that this Laura shows up after he tells her not to. She's pushy and she shows up anyway and kind of gets roped into it. And then as it goes on, because we find out, isn't the physical evidence of the scene, there's both of their DNA is on her body, right?
Both of their DNA cannot be excluded from things like the hacksaw. So that's where, you know, Colton has this line that he told us when we interviewed him in prison, where he started crying when, you know, her DNA couldn't be excluded, because he thought that was like his way out, essentially. Like, yeah, I didn't do it. Also, it was on the gun as well. Sorry, I forgot to mention that. But her DNA was both on those two things. And so when he found out, he was like, oh, cool. Like, yeah, it was my gun. And yeah, I got the hacksaw. But, you know, he's like, yeah, I didn't do it. There's her DNA. But, you know.
Yeah, I think ultimately what was really surprising to us was, like you said, when we first heard about the case, we thought it would be pretty cut and dry. Of course, we were hoping that there would maybe be like something, an interesting way to tell this story, right? Like, we knew that we were connected to this because of our unique position and where we were. But also we were like, we also want to present some new information to our listeners, or at least make this something that they haven't heard before. And very quickly we realized, you know, there are new developments to this, and there are a lot. But at the end of the day, after all our research was done, the most interesting part about it was, you know, no matter how much new material would present itself, first and foremost, not all of that can be used because of the initial trial that was done. Like, the way in which they can present things is very limited based on the original trial. Second, even if that is the case, even if you do think about the presence of Laura's DNA on something, that doesn't necessarily repaint the entire picture of the original trial either, because you know, if you like listen to the very long interrogation, Laura herself at some point admits like, yeah, I've handled a gun. That doesn't mean I shot it. So like the present, like all of this information, like when lined up in a specific way, what you learn about like the justice system in general, when lined up in any specific way or a different way, facts can be lined up so that a certain picture is painted. So it really just depends on like a courtroom's willingness to hear that specific lineup of facts. And that's the difficulty that people navigating the justice system face today, is just getting their like lineup of facts presented.
Right. Well, and unfortunately, maybe fortunately, I don't know who actually pulled the trigger, but you know, Colton, because of the strategy of his defense attorney, has, as you mentioned, is really handcuffed when it comes into post-conviction appeals, because, you know, he was asked directly on the stand, did you kill her? And he said yes. And when asked why he's saying yes, he said, because I can't think of any other explanation, paraphrasing, of course, he can't think of any other explanation. You know, he went home with her and he woke up and she was dead in his house, so he must have killed her. And so when any of these appeals items come in, like Laura's DNA or anything like that, it all gets balanced on the scales of justice as to, okay, well, even if that's the case, would that have been enough to change the outcome of the trial when you said on the stand that you killed her?
Right. Yeah. It's really hard to tell a new jury or present that to like even like a new judge and say, you know, this guy confessed, but on the stand, he confessed to doing this, but now he says he didn't do it. That's a really hard thing to like go back and like undo. But that is that's the strategy that his defense went with.
Right. And so, you know, legally, I don't know that he would ever be able to prove his innocence if he is, in fact, innocent. But on a practical level, you know, as we got into more of the Laura situation and learning more about her and some of these supposed, you know, alleged confessions and things like that, it kind of took me all the way back to the beginning, something I had just somehow breezed by at the very beginning of the podcast. And then it kind of snapped me back to it, is motive. Why would Colton kill her? They're friends. He's never had any history of violence or anything like that in his past. Why would he kill her and then go to bed? And if you look at Laura, it's like, well, you can at least imagine a motive there, because seems like she's head over heels for Colton, and he, you know, for lack of a better term, seems like, you know, he just uses her when it's convenient for him, but doesn't really like her the way she likes him. And now he's hanging out with this other girl. You can at least maybe imagine a motive there. And then, as I said, that's where that kind of unexpected ambiguity came in the way you presented this, because I found myself at the end thinking, God, maybe he really didn't kill her. Maybe he passed out. It also should be noted that didn't Jennifer, when they did her autopsy, she had like meth, marijuana, and alcohol all in her system. Is that right?
That is true. She did have a number of drugs in her system that night. One thing we do, you know, mention is like, that's whatever, you know, Jennifer was doing that night, we just didn't really want to focus on it. A lot of those questions and that intrigue really came in during the trial. And in our version of how we wanted to tell the story, we just didn't find that to be like the most riveting story. We explain it because like we know a lot of people that also, you know, do drugs, and that's not the story that we wanted to really tell. But yeah, absolutely. She did have those drugs in her system that night.
Right. I think, again, it's about the presentation of facts. So, you know, Colton was drinking heavily from that afternoon, and he was taking Xanax, which, you know, has been known to have, like, you know, effects that make you lose your memory. So if you put facts together like the prosecution had before, including the fact that he has shot a gun before accidentally in his apartment, when those facts are lined up, it could be said that maybe he accidentally shot her. And that's something that even he had told us in his interview. Like, I thought maybe at most I accidentally shot her, but I couldn't remember. And I never thought that I would ever do anything to her, anyone, let alone one of my best friends. And then, you know, if you don't think about that part, of course, it's very like easy to think about, oh, maybe someone else with a motive did this. But sometimes when something like this happens, there isn't a motive. It's an accident, but you never know. It just really depends on what facts you have available to you.
Right.
Again. Yeah.
Yeah. And the case is just so fascinating for me, who does crime scene reconstruction and profiling as part of my work on Truth and Justice, you know, like the drugs in her system. Like, to me, I'm looking at like victimology and what is that telling us about the moments leading to her death? And it's like, well, they were obviously partying pretty hard, you know, and with Colton at least having a history of drug dealing, you know, that maybe he was also doing the same drugs along with the Xanax and the alcohol. And that certainly could explain an accident. It also could certainly explain why he might have passed out and had no idea that she had been killed. It could go either way. I'm really hooked on the case where I want to look at more of the forensics on it too, like a crime scene reconstruction, because her body was found in a bathtub, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Was there any indication that it had been moved into the bathtub, or did it look like she was shot there in the bathtub or in the bathroom?
There was the fact of like a rug in the kitchen that was used to wrap the body up at some point. We don't know if that was used to move the body, but it seems to be that way because the rug was usually in the kitchen. It wasn't in the kitchen. It had been displaced and, you know, I guess there was DNA on it. So that might have been what it was. And also, like, you know, in Colton's latest appeals, they even like present an alternative perpetrator theory that has nothing to do with Laura, but present things like an eyewitness security guard from that night, as well as some other like testimonies that came in of people who said that they were at his apartment that night around the same time that Jennifer was that the prosecution presented that Jennifer had been killed. So if you look at it that way, again, presentation of facts, if you look at it that way, it couldn't have been Colton because it was someone else entirely. And like, not even Laura, you know, she wasn't even there. It was a whole other set of people that came in and had moved the body and did all that. So yeah, there's a lot of different ways to look at it, depending on what you know.
So as we're about to wrap this up, you guys as journalists, it's kind of your job to try to really remain neutral and just tell the story. Did either of you, through the process, form a personal opinion about a theory of the case, or did you just try not to even do that?
Yeah, that's a good question. And when people ask me that now that the podcast is over, you know, like what I think, I mean, I can tell you honestly, I have absolutely no idea. It is, I mean, in terms of our process, we always remained neutral, but just kind of like open to new information on both sides.
Yeah. I mean, as human beings, it's really impossible. Like, I mean, it's just, you know, that a journalist telling you, like, there's a difference between a journalist being very neutral and a reporter reporting something neutral, and then also the order of events in which they get information and their thought on what happened in a certain situation, given those order of facts. So of course, like, as we were going through it, we would get a specific fact and we would be like, that leads us to believe this. And then we would get another one and we would think that leads us to believe this. And so at the end of the day, like Haley said, at this point and like throughout the whole process, even when we were concluding the reporting, we were like still at a point where realistically we can't tell you what happened and we don't know. We don't have an opinion on that because it's really difficult to say. I mean, if the courts can't tell you, like, we're not anymore like, I don't know, we don't have any more facts than they do on that. However, throughout the process, it was a series of thinking one thing happened and then thinking another thing happened.
Sure. So was this the first or the largest scale journalistic project that you guys had worked on?
Yeah, I mean, outside of the ones we're working on now, 100%.
Definitely the longest.
Yeah.
Definitely the biggest production. Yeah. So yeah, definitely. It was the biggest thing I think both of us had done. It was a culmination of like all of the skills that we had gotten in journalism school, just really put to the test. And that was awesome. Also, you know, gaining new skills as we were doing it, but definitely for both of us, I think biggest thing we had done up until that point.
Yeah. And I mean, like the idea that like people, like we were working on stories about like the UT farm stand or like a local musician before this, you know, we always had an interest in like doing a bigger story, but in terms of what our classes and things allowed, we weren't able to do something like this. So it's crazy to think that we went from writing a story on like, you know, a campus incident to interviewing somebody that's never gone on the record before in prison.
Right. I feel like throughout journalism school, you know, there were several times where you see a lead to like a really interesting mystery that you're trying to solve. And like, there were stories that I did like that where it was like, I'm doing something cool and new, yeah. but then in comparison, it's very different. And this was like much larger scale, being able to talk to everyone involved, which is really cool. And also there was the support of all our professors, like, mm-hmm. like journalism and otherwise, to really pursue this. Whereas when you're pursuing something on your own, it's really hard to try to convince someone that this is something that they should really care about.
Yeah.
But with the backing of the whole, pretty much the whole J school, that was, we were able to do it.
Yeah.
With ease.
So this being your first big true crime project, and you said you got to talk to all the people connected to the case, or a lot of people, you know, you at least had some communication with Laura. You spoke with Colton in prison. You spoke with Colton's parents. You spoke with Jennifer's parents. What was, I guess, for our last question, I'll let each of you answer, what was that like for you? I know, you know, that's, again, as trained journalists, you're at your, all of your education tells you to keep your emotions out of it, your personal feelings out of it. But what was that like when you're, for you, maybe emotionally or just on a personal level, when you're talking to the parents of a woman who had been murdered, or talking to, you know, a man who's imprisoned for something that he's saying he didn't do?
Right. I mean, we quickly learned that like traditional neutrality kind of goes out of the window, especially when you're talking to the victim's family, which is something, you know, we just have never been presented before working on, you know, kind of like a campus story. But, you know, we went there to talk to Jennifer's family in Corpus Christi, to talk about somebody that we saw ourselves in, we saw our sisters in, we saw all of our friends in. And so to get into that space, you know, that headspace where we really wanted to learn about Jennifer and what she liked to do as a kid and what her relationship was like with her sister, you know, it's not like something that you can just be like, you know, very neutral about. Truthfully, like when we were interviewing and Sharon was telling us about her fight for on the behalf of Jennifer and why she does interviews like this and, you know, why she has so much advocacy, because she passed the Jennifer Cave Act, and you hear about that in the last episode. You know, I just couldn't help but think, you know, about my family, about my sister. Tanu has a sister and all of that. And I mean, I started to tear up, and I'm not very ashamed about it. And, you know, you think that you can't do that, like when you're taught in journalism school, but there's a certain point where your goal is to humanize people who have passed away, people where you don't know, you know, the struggles that they've been in court or behind the scenes or whatever. And you really have to get into that headspace. And I'm very glad I'm very glad we did. And I'm very glad we were able to tell that emotional story about what Jennifer's family experienced throughout this whole time. And to do that, we did have to throw away a little bit of neutrality and just put in a ton of empathy.
Yeah, I think I don't think that emotion necessarily like negates neutrality at all. I really do think that if we're presenting the world as it is to other human beings, we can't just be robotic about it and leave emotion out of it, because that's not really telling a story. That's presenting case facts. And if you're going to do that, people might as well just read about the court case online. And what we were doing was presenting a story from a unique perspective, and perspective includes emotions about a certain subject. And so that's kind of what we did. We tried to include emotions when it came to talking about Jennifer's story, as well as talking to Jennifer's family and what they're going through now, as well as Colton and his family. You know, right. Like we expressed the difficulties of navigating the Texas justice system. And, you know, truly like the emotions that we felt, you know, even going to the prison, regardless of like how we feel about the case specifically, like going into a prison and acknowledging that if there is a chance that someone innocent is facing this kind of sentence, that's a really difficult thing to grapple with. And, you know, both of us knowing that the Texas justice system works the way it does, we know that even if it's not Colton, there are other people in there
100%.
That definitely are serving sentences that, you know, they shouldn't be just serving. So all of that put together did make us emotional with that part of the story as well. And so we wanted to be able to express that to our listeners, at least in a little bit, so that they could fully understand what we were going through in the reporting process and be a little transparent about that.
Well, that's great. And you know, I agree with you 100%. It's when you take it to an audio medium, when you're trying to capture the real emotions of the people you're interviewing, it's hard to somehow turn that switch off in yourself. At least for me, when I'm doing that. And you guys did a great job, not only with that, but with the podcast in general. I would recommend any of you listening now that have not checked out the Orange Tree podcast. It was 7 parts, right?
7.
Yep. So it's 7 episodes. It's really well done. This is just an overview. That's a deep dive in the case. You'll hear from all these players. So definitely check that out. I'm looking forward to hearing your new projects come out in the spring. That sounds really exciting. And congratulations on your success with the Orange Tree.
Thank you so much. We'll keep you updated with our new stuff.
Fantastic.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production and is distributed by Wondery. Produced and edited by Mike Bussing and sound engineered by Shane Yoder. All music for the show is created, composed, and scored by PutThemInASong.com, who also mixed and mastered this episode. All of our font across all of our logos and banners were created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. You can find more of Tate's work on Etsy. Thank you to Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com for designing, creating, managing, and maintaining our website, TruthAndJusticePod.com, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. Thank you to our transcription team, Pamela Westby, Kathy McElhaney, Charlena White, Kay Wood Yomnick, Ginger Fiola, Edith Swanneck, Lindsay Pease, and Jen Reese in Candela. And as always, thank you to all of you for all of your engagement and support. If you like the show and you'd like to support us, you can do so in a number of ways. To financially support the show, you can go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. On the Patreon page, you can pledge as little as $3 a month, and we also have reward levels. For just $5 a month, you get access to ad-free versions of all of our episodes and behind-the-scenes videos of the creation of our Friday follow-up episodes that always include 10 to 30 minutes of pre-show bonus chat. Other reward levels include t-shirts, hats, and even the opportunity to co-host one of our Friday follow-up episodes. To become a patron, just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. And lastly, you can always support us by supporting the companies that sponsor this program. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider for future seasons, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is to engage in our investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. For all of you tweeters, you can connect with us on Twitter at Truth Justice Pod. And I personally can be found on social media at Bob Ruff Truth, and Mike can be found at Merb Gaming. MURRBGAMING. Don't forget that we always have our 24/7 voicemail line open for questions, comments, or tips on our cases. That phone number is 269-224-2833. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, I'm signing off. I'm Bob Ruff, and this has been Truth and Justice.